The Baseball Tonight podcast is presented by LinkedIn Jobs.
Way out of here. Oh,
goodness. This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, July 1st, 2021. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home in New York. And Taylor, didn't see any of this coming. Woof.
No.
Start with this. Congrats to Mississippi State. The Bulldogs beat Vanderbilt to win the College World Series. And Shohei Ohtani started Yankee Stadium, resulted in him allowing 7 first-inning runs. And yet it would turn out to be a great day for the Angels. What a wild turn of events, a crazy day of comebacks. And nothing like we would have imagined.
No, you were talking about how, oh man, I'm going to have to flip around. You know, I'm going to have to stay up late. You didn't have to stay up late and you didn't have to flip around. So it was a bit kind of a win for you almost, even though it's tough that Vanderbilt lost. I was hoping that we were going to melt down the cowbells this morning, but that is not the case.
Well, I did see the end of the Angels and Yankees game, which was like 1 o'clock in the morning. Would that one turn out? But yeah, when Vanderbilt fell behind 9-0, then I kind of checked out there. I was too depressed as an alum. And who would have guessed that Shohei Ohtani wouldn't even make it out of the first inning? He made that start amid a lot of anticipation, and he struggled to throw strikes.
Line drive, a base hit to left field. LeMahieu scores. They'll hold Boyd at third. It's an RBI single for Stanton. Yankees on the board. It's 2-1 Angels.
Standing by the air conditioner.
That one's through for base hit. Sanchez will stop at third. It's an RBI single for Torres. And the game is tied at 2 and still nobody out.
And they would go on and on and on. That was Michael Kay and David Cohn on the Yes Network. At the end of the first inning, the Yankees led 7-2. The most runs allowed by Ohtani in any start. He came out after just 2/3 of an inning and about 40 pitches. But the Yankees kept squandering chances to extend their lead. And in the 9th inning, the Angels loaded the bases, and this happened.
He gives that one a run.
Aroldis Chapman blowing another save. The Angels are going to win 11-8, a terrible loss for the Yankees in their current context. And after the game, Aaron Boone was blunt.
Terrible loss, you know, and you know, continue to have good at-bats and give ourselves chances to blow the game open and couldn't get it done. So let them hang around enough. And then it was obviously a struggle there in the 9th. You know, today just struggled, obviously finding the zone. So, you know, and credit the Angels, worked some good at bats against them, and then obviously a big swing. So, frustrating, disappointing, terrible. You know, we got to pick ourselves up.
And the crowd at Yankee Stadium that remained at the end of this game was very clear about how they feel. If you can't make it out there chanting Fire Boone, we're going to be talking with Sarah Langs about that and maybe what Hal Steinbrenner will admit later today. What a wild game in Milwaukee. The Brewers fell behind 7-0 to the Cubs, but then they fired back.
Brothers deals, and that's through. A base hit. One is in. Adames. Here comes Taylor. Throw to the plate. And safe. The Brewers lead.
Boy, what a slide. Wow.
Yeah, and so the Brewers would come all the way back, and they would score 15 unanswered runs to win 15-7 at the end of the day. The Brewers 6 games ahead of the Cubs in National League Central, and we'll talk about what this could mean for the trade market. Here was Frank Schwindel's first at-bat for the Oakland Athletics.
Here's the 1-0 pitch to him, and Frank hits it to deep left field in the corner. If it's fair, it's gone right down the line, and gone! Frank Schwindel! Frank the Tank in his first Athletics at bat. A towering home run down the left field line. What a debut.
Yeah, I got to say too, Taylor, like the home run he hit was an absolute bomb. If you got Ken Korak calling you Frank the Tank on Oakland radio, that's the type of home run you'd want.
It's got to be a bomb. If it's not a bomb, if it just squeaks out, you're not Frank the Tank. So glad he earned his stripes.
Frank Schwindel. He's my new favorite Oakland player with a great nickname by Ken. I absolutely love that. A cool moment for Joey Votto in Cincinnati yesterday.
The man thought Musgrove not great to go more than four. Votto annihilates it to right field. 1,000 RBIs.
Joey Votto, 1,000 career RBI. The fans called him out for a curtain call. The Padres would come back and win that game 7-5, however. The Braves got to frolic in the midst of a tough offensive year.
Ozzie whacks one high in the air, deep right center field, rising back towards the wall, and this one is gone. Ozzie Albies with his second home run of the night. It's a 7 RBI night for Ozzie Albies.
That from 680, the fan, the Braves putting up 20 runs against the Mets. The Mets announced that reliever Dellin Betances will have surgery on his right shoulder, and he will miss the remainder of the year after pitching just one time in the 2021 season. Josh Donaldson and Lucas Giolito had a major verbal flare-up, and Donaldson got the last word yesterday. This all started on Tuesday when Donaldson crossed home plate after hitting a home run off Giolito, yelling out, "Hands not sticky anymore." Give a listen.
Here, once again.
Yeah, that from the Twins television broadcast. Well, Giolito was asked by reporters about that.
He's a pest. You know, that's kind of a classless move. If you're going to talk to my face.
And before yesterday's game, Donaldson responded to what Giolito had to say.
All right, let's go look at his numbers. What do the numbers say? Right. And what do we know about the sticky substance? What does it do? What does it help with? It helps with RPMs. It helps with spin rate. Well, guess what? Mr. Giolito, your fastball spin rate's down 200. Your curveball spin rate's down 400-500. Your slider's down 200. So, look, if we're going to talk about class, what side are you going to choose? Are you going to take the side of someone who's playing the game fair? Or are you going to take the side of somebody that was probably cheating before this happened?
And then in his first plate appearance in last night's game, this is what happened.
A high fly to left, and Donaldson drops the bat. He thinks he's got another one, and there it goes.
Well, sometimes as a player, you invite that stuff in, and it just gives you a little extra edge.
That from the Twins television network. Yeah, Donaldson stood at home plate and enjoyed that one. But in the end, the Twins would lose again.
1-2, fly ball out in the deep left center. Gordon tracking. He's at the wall. It's gone! That is a two-run blast. Andrew Vaughn gives the Sox the lead.
That was Len Casper on ESPN 1000. The White Sox win 13-3. Major League Baseball announced Wednesday that former New York Mets general manager Jared Porter has been placed on the ineligible list through at least the end of the 2022 season. And a domestic violence restraining order filed against Los Angeles Dodger pitcher Trevor Bauer, executed on June 28th, included multiple graphic images from the woman who filed the request in the 67-page ex parte document, which was obtained by The Athletic. The woman said Bauer assaulted her on two different occasions, punching her in the face and buttocks and strangling her to the point where she lost consciousness several times. We'll be talking today with author Luke Eplin about his new book about Larry Doby and others who helped Cleveland win its last championship. And before we get to Sarah Langs and to Luke, check out ESPN Plus for all of Euro 2020 action. The semifinals start on Friday at noon Eastern time. Sign up now to watch at ESPNplus.com.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11 ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
0-0-9-6.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter and producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, of all the possible outcomes of that Yankee game last night, oh my God, did anybody bet on that? That Shohei Ohtani would be historically bad for him and that the Angels would win the game? What a crazy game that was.
You know, it's funny because a week ago on Thursday, we were talking about all of those crazy games, right? That was after all of those four kind of roller coaster games we were talking about. And I was getting up this morning and maybe there weren't four of them, but same kind of concept. When we were talking about Aroldis Chapman, we're talking about the fact that, I mean, you know, what was it, a week and a half ago, he got out of a situation where he would have allowed multiple, at least a run, if not for a triple play. And here he is again faltering. So, I mean, just absolutely, I don't think what anyone would have envisioned when Ohtani didn't even get out of the first inning. And I mean, any fans that stayed there, all the reporters that were there that entire time, I mean, that game, I think it was the last game to end last night, despite being an East Coast 7 o'clock game, which is wild.
Ohtani, I think, is going to win the MVP of the American League this year because he's been so phenomenal. One thing I would say that at age 26 about him as a pitcher is that one way to describe him is he is imprecise. He can be imprecise. Even on his best days as a pitcher, he will walk some guys. And last night, you know, as pointed out on the Yes Network, the home plate umpire called a very consistent strike zone, but he was not getting calls on the edges, and he can get into these roles where he struggles to find the strike zone.
Absolutely. And that's really what we've seen from him when he has struggled at any point in his pitching career, at least at the major league level, is those walks. I mean, when you look at the box score, you see that he allowed 7 runs in the first inning to the Yankees. We know they have Judge, Sanchez, Stanton, everybody. You're kind of expecting there to be a home run along that line as you go through it. But instead, it's those 4 walks. And we saw that earlier in the year, too. And yep. I remember you and I talked about when he had that start where his velocity was down, and we're talking a little bit about how deep into games he was going, it has compromised his ability to go deep. Obviously last night was separate. I mean, allowing those 7 runs need to be removed, but even these other starts he's had, a lot of them have been just about 5 innings, and it's because his pitch counts get up pretty quickly with how many guys that he does walk.
Yeah. And on the other side of the ledger, the Yankees losing this game, no question, their worst loss of the year in a season in which they had a number of bad losses, you know, to have that big of a lead. It felt like even as the game was going along and he had some rain delays, Sarah, they had opportunities to just bury the Angels and they failed to do it time and time and time again. And that said, you would expect to hold a lead in the ninth inning of that magnitude. But Aroldis Chapman in the month of June, 11.42 ERA, 8 2/3 innings, 3 homers, 10 walks, 11 strikeouts. You know, we've talked about, you know, how there's this mass reassessment in baseball going on about, you know, baseball since the foreign substance crackdown and which pitchers may have been using. Look, he'd have to be one of the guys you throw into that conversation. And I don't know if he was someone who used foreign substances before, but his performance is so dramatically different this month.
It certainly is. But, you know, I feel like the days of Aroldis Chapman, absolute lockdown closer, have been gone for at least a year or two now. I mean, I know making those relief pitcher lists, all that stuff we do in the offseason, he wasn't a definitive number 1 or 2 or maybe even 3 for me, I don't think, in each of the last 2 years. And he's been more and more ineffective. I mean, I think just, you know, maybe walking guys a little bit more and You know, everything that you're alluding to, there's no question that this month has been particularly bad, but I do think that he hasn't been that absolute, you know, that the ninth inning is over type of guy for, I want to say, at least a year, if not a year and a half now.
We had Tyler Kepner of the New York Times in the podcast yesterday, and we talked about how under Brian Cashman, the Yankees have not fired a manager in season. They've not fired a coach in midseason. And I was thinking about that game last night that, you know what, if it was a different owner, if it was a different general manager, that would be a game that would lead to somebody getting fired. You know, they were calling for Aaron Boone's firing. The fans were chanting that at the end of the game. And you as a longtime Mets fan under previous ownership, under the Wilpons, I have no doubt after a game like that, that someone would have been fired by the Mets.
I mean, I'm thinking of, I want to say it was 2014. The Mets had a game where Jose Valverde blew a save. I want to say this was like May, something like that. And I believe that's after that game, they removed him from the closer's role. They fired their hitting coach. I mean, they were in the midst of a bad stretch. It wasn't just that game, but you do see that sort of reactiveness or whatever else you want to say from other clubs. But I remember you asking, I mean, I think I looked into that, not changing managers in season. What was that at this point, like a month and a half ago, to talk to you about? And I think it was two teams that have gone longer without doing that. It was, I think, the Twins and the Giants. But, you know, I don't think that these types of issues are really managerial. I understand that fans, especially sitting there at midnight in the Bronx when they got there at probably 5 p.m., I understand that you want someone to blame, and you're not going to say fire a hitter or a pitcher or something, because you know that those things won't actually happen. So I understand where that sort of energy comes from. But I mean, you know, this is, as you said, Aroldis Chapman struggling, and certainly the team maybe failing to pile on a little bit. But again, I have trouble connecting those directly to a manager.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, if you hand a major league pitcher, especially someone with a track record of Aroldis Chapman, even if he's not as good as has been in the past, you hand that pitcher that lead in that spot, you would expect to find out. I will say this. We have no indication yet that Hal Steinbrenner has a fiery temper. If he's got a fiery temper, we may find out today about that. If, in fact, they change course, because that is the type of loss that gets people fired. There's no doubt about it. The Chicago Cubs had a lead yesterday, but the Brewers came storming back. And it's amazing how quickly this change has changed, Sarah, that, you know, 10 days ago, we're talking about the Cubs being near the top of the National League Central. Are they going to be buyers rather than sellers? Now they've lost so much ground so quickly. I actually think they could make this very easy for the Cubs front office, which I think will make an unemotional decision about whether to try to contend. I think that the front office there, the ownership there, was fully prepared to sell in midseason this year if it didn't happen. I looked it up this morning, Sarah. On Fangraphs, they have the Cubs' chances of making the playoffs at 14%. And if that's kind of the range that they're sitting at in, say, July 20th, I have no doubt that they'll start moving pieces. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I feel like we were here talking 2 weeks ago about how, you know, Chris Bryant, and he's playing so well, but the Cubs are playing well. They're in first place. They can't trade him. This is such a difficult spot for a team to be in. And now they're six games behind. That's the largest division lead in any division in baseball here entering July. I was working on something last night about, you know, division winners go on to win. It's about two-thirds of the time if you're in first place entering July that you go on to. And I was shocked by that number, that six. I mean, we've seen larger division leads. You know, the Dodgers at this point in 2019 were up by like 11 games. But the fact that that isn't just them in second place, but that they're so much further behind than any other team in baseball that's in second place, I think that sort of makes that decision right there. And they really have not looked good lately. I mean, obviously yesterday getting out to the 7-run lead, ending up losing 15-7, and they've now had two of those really bad innings in a 3 or 4 day span. And this was a team where we were hearing about the bullpen as a lot of the strength for them. especially over the last month or so. And Craig Kimbrell is still really good, but you know, when you're up 7-0 and then it's 15-7, you're not getting to Craig Kimbrell. And I think that a lot of those other bullpen pieces that had really been sustaining them, I mean, the bullpen helped them get through a bad start to the season for Kyle Hendricks, which nobody saw coming. It seems like some of that is coming back down to earth for them. And, you know, ultimately, I think Chris Bryant is going to continue to have this really good year, but Rizzo has missed time. They've had all these various injuries, and I do think the Brewers are better overall. I think they have question marks as well. Theirs are purely offense for the most part, but you know, they have that 6-game lead. So I don't know what else you can say about where the Cubs are at.
Yeah. And I got to say, the Cubs roster would be an absolute one-stop shop bonanza for any potential buyer. Like they have so many, what is it? 15, 16 potential free agents. And you know, the Cubs would be open to all of them. There'd be a lot of conversation about Anthony Rizzo, about Bryant, about Javier Baez. Teams probably would call about Wilson Contreras, although he's not a free agent at year's end. But I have no doubt that the most coveted piece that the Cubs have in the trade market would be Kimbrell. Because of his dominance this year, and oh, by the way, continued dominance after we got in the sticky stuff conversation and the crackdown. And on top of that, he's got a club option for 2022. So if you're a contending team, and I'm just throwing it out there, you know, the San Francisco Giants, for example, you're very positive about it. You're the, you know, you're the Padres. You're looking for a difference making reliever. You're the Yankees now. And you are, you know, looking ahead. You could look at a Kimbrell and say, boy, we'd be buying in for this year. And there's every indication that he'll be successful next year. How about the Red Sox? You know, him going back to Boston, pitching for Alex Cora again, that would be another candidate. I think he's going to be the guy most targeted by other teams. What do you think?
Absolutely. Every team needs bullpen help. Every single contender or team that wants to be a contender needs bullpen help. I'm thinking of the Blue Jays. You know, last night they lost that game largely because they don't really have any absolute definitive go-to in that bullpen. And they've needed a closer. So, you know, they signed Kirby Yates and he was hurt. So Jordan Romano has been the closer, but certainly Kimbrell would be a far better option. I think that's true of a lot of teams, but you know, I don't know exactly what you chalk this up to, but if you're the Cubs front office and you are starting to field those offers, I mean, you must feel pretty great about that investment because you look at that Craig Kimbrell deal. The first 2 years, he had a 6.53 ERA in 2019, 5.28 last year, and it's 30 innings this year, but 0.59. I mean, you know, patience, whatever else. And now is, you know, it's unfortunate that they may not be able to fully reap the benefits and they may instead end up trading him and that's what they would get back. But I just think about how much of a, you know, train wreck that deal seemed to be initially. And he's completely changed that this year, which, I mean, it's just such a great comeback to see. I think that he's one of those closers in that Chapman conversation that we've just become so reliant on, knowing that he would be a great option at the end. The last 2 years, that wasn't true. So it's just great to see that again.
Fascinating back and forth, entertaining back and forth between Josh Donaldson and Lucas Giolito. The one thing I'd say about that whole thing with Giolito firing back at Donaldson and Donaldson hitting the home run yesterday after he fired back at Giolito, I think that we need to keep this in mind as we have the sticky stuff conversation. Yes, last week we heard from Max Scherzer, from Clayton Kershaw, Tyler Glasnow, other, you know, Garrett Richards, other pitchers. There are a whole bunch of players who come at this from a very different perspective that we really haven't heard that much from. Players who feel like the pitchers have been competing with an unfair advantage and are now going to have to start adjusting back to the old norm. No longer can pitchers just throw fastball after fastball at the top of the zone and wiffle ball breaking balls at the bottom of the zone. And you know, Lucas Giolito, clearly, you know, great guy. He's fun. He's entertaining. If you were a close friend, I would say, you know what, dude, you just got to wear this one. You just have to say nothing because you've got all these. And I'd say that to all pitchers in this situation. You know, it's pretty clear now from the information we have that pitchers gained an advantage at the expense of their position player brethren for a couple of years. They took advantage of it. They lived high on the hog. And guess what? It's coming back to, you know, going back to baseline. And if there are position players that have something to say, I don't think it behooves the pitchers to complain about it. I think they just got to move on. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. That's how I feel about most of these feuds, is that, you know, ultimately it's decided on the field and, you know, it's just extra talk and whatever else. But I did enjoy that Lucas Giolito's father got in on this and tweeted, you know, thanks Josh Donaldson.
What did he tweet?
He said, he tweeted, thanks Josh Donaldson, or maybe he tagged him, I don't remember, for giving my son extra motivation, something like that. And I did enjoy that. I mean, I love the father getting in on the feud via Twitter. Like, that's the most 2021 thing ever. And I enjoyed that additional part. But yeah, I mean, I think we've certainly heard about this primarily from the pitcher perspective, to your point. And we all know that, you know, any changes that are coming about as a result of this are, of course, also affecting the hitters. And, you know, a hitter like Josh Donaldson has been around a while. So, you know, if this is perceived as something that was really growing over the last few years, he was certainly around prior to that as well. So, you know, everybody's allowed to have their perspectives on that. And it's true that we haven't really heard that much from the hitter side in terms of what they're expecting to happen or, you know, how they feel about this change.
Yeah, I'll repeat the story that I think I told on Monday to Tim, that a general manager said to me, to hear pitchers complain about what's going on is like listening to a bank robber who's hit the same bank over and over and over again, and then going, wait a second, they're putting in security cameras? What that's not fair. This is from a major league general manager who doesn't want to hear it from pitchers. It's like, no, you know what? Just go about your business, try to make your adjustments and try to get better.
Absolutely. Right. And we've seen a lot of guys already adjusting. You know, Garrett Richards had some interesting stuff to say the other day. I know that's a couple of days old now, but.
Yeah, that was, yeah. And he seems to have gotten used to the reality that he's just going to have to pitch differently. I've loved the last few days listening to David Cone talk about it on the Yes Network. Essentially, like, you're going to have to learn how to pitch. You just can't throw the ball at the top of the zone over and over and over again. So we'll be watching that going forward. All right, Sarah, thank you.
Thank you, Buster.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
Luke Eplin is the author of Our Team, the epic story of four men and the World Series that changed baseball. Luke, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Thanks for joining me. Very excited about this. I remember reading about this book as it was about to come out in the spring. And I was like, that is going to be great. Obviously got great reviews, a great response. The four men referenced in the title there, the four key members of the Cleveland organization, owner Bill Veeck, pitcher Bob Feller, pitcher Satchel Paige, and of course, Larry Doby, they would win the World Series. And we're coming up on the 74th anniversary of Doby's debut, July 5th, 1947. Most casual fans know Doby as the first African-American in American League history. How did you feel about Larry Doby at the end of the project? because you know him, you know, as you go into it. But by the time you got to the end, how did you feel about him?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually didn't know a lot about Larry Doby whenever I started the book. I knew him as sort of an answer to a trivia question. As you said, the first black player in the American League, the second black player after Jackie Robinson in the 20th century. But other than that, he was kind of a mystery to me. And this sort of courage and perseverance that he had to have to do what he did, he went straight from the Negro Leagues to the major leagues with no training in between. It was kind of like an overnight journey into the majors that differed very significantly from Jackie Robinson's own journey. And so it really was a sort of singular experience that he went under. And so just to sort of see him, you know, struggle through it and then have this incredible year in 1948 that really helped the Indians to the World Series made me just appreciate his gifts and sort of almost be a little sad that his story hasn't been as well told as perhaps Robinson's.
Yeah, we obviously know a lot about Jackie Robinson. There have been so many books written, you know, the movie 42. How did Larry Doby handle this?
Well, it was a real shock to his system. He found out that he was going to be signed by the Cleveland Indians only about 2 days before it happened. He played a game for the Newark Eagles, which were part of the Negro National League, on July 4th, 1947, took an overnight train to Chicago, where the Indians were playing the White Sox. And the very next day, he was in a uniform with the Cleveland Indians. He later told sports writer Wendell Smith that during his first several at-bats in the majors, he was so nervous that his teeth were chattering. He was often segregated from his teammates, shunted off to separate accommodations. He roomed by himself. He sort of struggled with loneliness and sort of tremendous racial abuse, as well as a cold shoulder from some of his teammates. And so during that first year in 1947, he really struggled. It seemed like he was not major league material. But then in 1948, as I had mentioned, he has this tremendous comeback where he is just sort of constantly spurring the Indians whenever they are hitting a rough patch. And he's really the catalyst that helped them through that season.
Yeah, I was thinking about this today as we're getting ready to talk to you. You know, we talk about Jackie Robinson because he was the first African-American to play in MLB. But there were effectively 16 firsts.
Yeah.
There were 16 teams, 16 sets of players, clubhouse cultures, fan bases. So Doby had the same set of challenges that Jackie Robinson did. I've seen things written in the past about how Jackie Robinson, you know, may have made it easier for so-and-so. There, nobody was going to make it easier for Larry Doby with what he dealt with. So how did he turn the corner from that, from those initial struggles into the second year? And how did the Cleveland franchise view him after that first year? Because as you know, part of the reason why Branch Rickey chose Jackie Robinson was because he felt like, you know what, the first is a player who has to have immediate success. And as you mentioned, Larry Doby didn't.
Yeah, and there was kind of a pattern that if black players did not sort of excel right off the bat, as Jackie Robinson sort of did after a slightly rough patch at the beginning, they were sent back to either the minors or to the Negro Leagues altogether. Doby was able to sort of weather the storm a bit because he had a very supportive owner in Bill Veeck, who knew that Doby had talent and practiced sort of patience and allowing Doby to find his footing within the league. Doby found a community of black Clevelanders at that time. He lived with a guy named Arthur Grant, who Doby had served with in the Navy. And that allowed him to sort of form a community that he drew strength from. He also drew strength from his wife. And then there were several Cleveland coaches that really helped him along, like Bill McKechnie and Tris Speaker, who was from Texas and really saw in Doby a tremendous talent. Doby not only came back in 1948, after having kind of a disastrous 1947 season in which he hit 156, he had been an infielder in the Negro Leagues. The Indians told him after the 1947 season, you need to go learn how to do the outfield. He was so inexperienced in the outfield, he was checking out books from the library in the offseason called How to Play the Outfield. He didn't know how to play it. And he just learns it on the fly while being the sole individual black player in the American League during that 1948 season. So not only is he dealing with sort of the challenges that come with being a pioneer, he's learning an entirely new position, and he just kind of attacks it with the tenacity that he'd shown earlier in his athletic career.
What really stood out to you as you researched Bill Veeck? Who I mean, he's one of the pioneers in baseball in terms of marketing the sport, in terms of trying to make the sport more popular. But I've always thought of him as being, you know, there's going to be the natural comparison to Branch Rickey. I've always thought of Bill Veeck as being more progressive in thought, whereas Rickey was more of a pragmatist than a businessman. Tell me what you thought you felt about Bill Veeck.
Yeah, I mean, I'm someone who comes from St. Louis, and so I grew up hearing stories about Veeck on the St. Louis Browns. And so I got almost like a carnivalization picture of Bill Veeck, where he was shooting off fireworks, doing sort of outrageous stunts and promotions and things like this.
He was the guy with Eddie Goodell that put the midget right up to the plate, that sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah, that was more the sort of picture that I had. And so it was surprising to me when I was doing this research on just how progressive Veeck was in terms of desegregating the American League. He grew up in Chicago, which at that time was sort of the nerve center of the Negro League. And he went to tons of different games, both the East-West All-Star game for the Negro Leagues and the Chicago American Giants. He knew players in the Negro League so well that one Cleveland sports writer said that he not only could tell you who these players were, but he could give you sort of stats about them, tell you where they played in the field. He recognized the talent and the skill of these players in the Negro Leagues. And he also recognized that Negro League owners needed to be compensated for finding, scouting, developing these players. Unlike Rickey, who kind of thought that the Negro Leagues was more along the lines of a racket and did not compensate owners at first for the players that he signed for them. And so he really sort of had a more inclusive nature in terms of that. And I mean, the relationship that Bill Veeck formed with Larry Doby was extremely tight. If Doby was at a bad spot, Veeck would take him out to dinner. They'd go to a jazz bar. They'd sort of listen to jazz, just a show of expression of his support for Doby, to know that we can get through this time. And it was a bond that lasted throughout their entire life.
Tell me what you learned about Satchel Paige.
Well, Satchel Paige for me was kind of along the lines of Veeck. I knew the sort of tall tales about him, of him sort of calling the fielders off the field so he could get batters out on his own, the sort of nicknames he had for pitches, his distinctive style. But what I really learned about Satchel Paige was I think he is the greatest entrepreneurial athlete that this country has ever known. He came from the depths of the Deep South during a time of extreme Jim Crow and segregation laws. And within sort of a decade of professional baseball, he builds himself up into basically a one-man franchise. He is belonging to certain teams like the Pittsburgh Crawfords and whatnot, but he's also leasing out his services to semi-pro teams or other teams that could use a boost for their bottom line. And he's pocketing gate receipts. And during a time whenever, you know, the Negro Leagues were in pretty dire financial straits, Satchel Paige is making about as much money as a superstar in the major leagues. In fact, he says at oftentimes when people ask him why he's not in the majors, he says it's because the major leagues can't pay him enough to be there. I mean, just the idea of him building himself up into this sort of extremely forward-thinking entrepreneurial businessman during that time, I think is an incredible feat, and one that you know, athletes from ranging from Michael Jordan to LeBron James, you know, really follow in that line.
So I always have felt like, look, when we have the conversation about the greatest pitcher ever, you know, now it would include a Clayton Kershaw, a Pedro Martinez, you know, Roger Clemens, Sandy Koufax, Walter Johnson. I always thought Satchel Paige should be in that conversation. Tell me about what you learned about him as a pitcher in doing this.
Well, there's no doubt about it. He had a sort of swiftness to his pitches that was evident from a very early age, very similar to Bob Feller's swiftness, which was also evident from an early age. But what people really sort of ingrained in him during his apprenticeship was command. He could put the ball wherever he wanted to over the plate. And so he's not only sort of throwing fast and hard, but he was sort of a master at painting the corners. And he always, I mean, he was a very cerebral pitcher as well. He would say that he could sort of look at your stance, or he could look at the way that you're swinging in the batter's box and sort of immediately begin to identify where your weaknesses were and then throw the ball exactly there. air. One of the things that he used to do while warming up was taking like a chewing gum wrapper or a dime and having the catcher put it on various parts of the plate. And then he'd just throw pitch over pitch after the, over the chewing gum wrapper. And so really it's that sort of control that allows him not only to excel, but the longevity that then defines his career.
Yeah, which is why, among modern pitchers, I think of him, the closest comp might actually be Jacob DeGrom, who, as you know, you watch him pitch and he just owns this 3-inch sliver right off the plate. And he sort of had that same angularity that that Satchel Paige did. I learned more than any of the people that you wrote about in your book, learned more about Bob Feller, who, as you know, he was be around the Indians for the rest of his life after his career ended. He would go down and do fantasy camps. But I didn't realize sort of the way that he was regarded within that organization in the way that he was. Can you just describe that? That was fascinating to me.
Well, Bob Feller was a sensation from the time that he comes into Major League Baseball. His origin story, I think, is unlike any other that you can imagine in baseball. He comes from a small town in rural Iowa. His father senses an extraordinary ability in him from a young age, so he clears off a patch of their farmland, builds him what is basically the field of dreams. Feller makes the Indians at age 17 and his very first Major League start ever. He ties the American League record for strikeouts. Four starts later, he ties the Major League record. He is so famous that his high school graduation is broadcast live from coast to coast on radio. And Feller really knows how to sort of leverage that story. Like Paige, he has a very entrepreneurial bent to him. He spends sort of a lot of his career just kind of like self-mythologizing and really looking for ways to sort of capitalize on his fame and his fortune through barnstorming tours, through radio programs, through everything like that. What kind of happens in 1947 and 1948 is that he stumbles a little bit as a pitcher. He gets a little bit injured. His fastball kind of loses some speed. And then once that happens, fans kind of start to turn on him a little bit. They think that he is devoting too much time to his outside interests and not enough time to pitching. And so he becomes kind of almost like a villain to a lot of Major League Baseball at that time. And I think it's something you could see nowadays. Anytime an athlete seems to not be playing as well, people will say, oh, he's too distracted by endorsements or relationships or whatever. It's definitely a manifestation of that.
So earlier this year, we were talking with the director of 42, and I asked him about the coolest response that he got to that movie, and he told this great story about Rachel Robinson, you know, sitting and screening it for the first time. I'm curious about you, as you finish this book and you unveil it, what was a cool response that you got to it that really stuck with you?
I mean, I've been very heartened by how many people seem to have enjoyed it. I was most worried about the response by Bob Feller's family. I go into a little bit of depth about how Feller was perhaps a little bit more along the traditionalist side when it came to integration. He sometimes would say to the press that he didn't believe that there were any Black players that were ready to be in the major leagues. And his family reached out to me and said that they thought that it was one of the better one of the better portraits of their father that they'd seen, and that they thought that you had to show all sides for that. It's been really heartening.
Tell me about what you've heard from Cleveland fans, especially older fans. I'm sure you've gotten a lot of response.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm really excited whenever anybody writes to me and says that either they were at a certain game of the 1948 World Series or their father was at the games. I've had so many people send me pictures of the ticket stubs that they've saved from the 1948 World Series. And it seems like a lot of Clevelanders that were alive during 1948 had some sort of interaction with Bill Veeck. He was out and about on the town always. He loved to sort of roam through the stadium and chat people up. It seemed that if you were in Cleveland during that time, you would have just run into him. It was almost like he was the mayor of that town.
I got to tell you, when you look at pictures of the 1948 World Series, it reminds me of pictures you would see now of the Kentucky Derby. Like in terms of the mass of people who were involved, it almost takes your breath away.
Well, and I mean, some of these newspapers, you have not only sort of, it's 86,000 people for game five in the 1948 World Series.
86,000 people.
Yeah, in a stadium built for 78,000. And so they put a lot of these people beyond the fences in the field, but you can also find newspaper clippings of people literally under the seats, just kind of trying to watch through the little slats between between the seats. I mean, there's just people hanging on pipes, hanging on railings, just sprawled out on newspapers across the runways. I mean, it's like every square inch of that stadium was full.
Wow. Well, you did a great job of the book. I really enjoyed it. Congrats on your success. And I'm looking forward to your next project.
Thanks, Buster. It's been an honor.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. First up, we have Sean Sullivan at For You, Kevin. Sean writes, and Buster has objectively covered baseball for many a year. When a team like Vandy plays, what parts of your fan brain turns on again? Do you root against the other team? Do you think the ump is blind? Is it easy or a tough switch to flip on and off?
It's completely impossible. I will watch a game as a fan and be rooting for Vanderbilt or rooting for my Minnesota Vikings. But I will watch a game objectively, and it kind of drives my son crazy. Taylor will be watching the Braves game together, and you know, I'll be in those moments, I'll be rooting for my son and happy for him, you know, or the Titans. Mm-hmm. And somebody on the other team will make a nice play, and I'll just reflexively go, "Ooh, nice catch."
Right.
And boy, does that enrage Jake. I mean, he wants me all in on him for his team, which I respect, but I just can't do it. Like, I still, you know, kind of look at stuff from 30,000 feet, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, I understand Jake wanted you to be a blind homer with them.
Totally get it. I totally get it from his perspective. And that's why I kind of mute it to some degree when I sit and watch with him. Oh, the Titan. But when he goes into the thing, you know, the Titans, like in a playoff game, was against the Chiefs a couple of years ago, and they got absolutely routed. And after the end of the game, he said, "Yeah, that holding call in the first inning or first quarter changed everything." And I'm just like, "Oh, no, dude, they got crushed."
That's funny. Let's go to our guy, Paul Swanick at Welsh Brewer 70. Again, about the Brewers writing in. "Now you guys have to focus on the Brewers down 7 after the first inning and to win with 15 unanswered runs. We may not be the Yankees, Dodgers, or Giants, but give a small market team some love, please." I think we did that today.
Paul, yesterday, and you can back me up on this, Taylor. Yesterday and today, how much have we talked about the Dodgers and the Giants?
None today, for sure.
And yesterday, we pretty much didn't talk about those teams. The last 2 days, have we talked about the Brewers?
Yes, we did, at Paul's request, and because they're playing well, too.
There we go.
All right. Okay. Check the box. Let's go to School of Sweat, Brian Stone King. He writes in, "What can we do to change the meaning of the term modern era to reflect from 1970 to present day? That's 50-plus years of comparisons to make. Even though everything pre-2000 isn't comparable already, at least it would be more relevant to today's game." I agree with Brian here, but I know this is a baseball thing.
Well, and it's just a phrasing, right, that the Elias Sports Bureau puts out. It's mm-hmm. sort of like the Mesozoic era. The one thing I would say is that if you say modern era, maybe to Brian's point, maybe we should capitalize modern era. If they're going to define it as, 1900 forward, should that maybe you make that in capitals as opposed to a description? Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. That way we know for sure. But I mean, Brian, when you're talking with your friends and you're saying modern era, I mean, everyone knows, like, you're talking last 20, 30 years. So
that's the way it feels. I mean, that yeah. If you use it as that phrase as a descriptive phrase.
Yeah,
lowercase. Yeah, no question.
All right. Last one for today. Eric Sorensen at Coach Sorensen 9. He writes and sent a nice picture. "Don't you miss baling and hauling hay? Yesterday it was 110 degrees here in Ellensburg, Washington. Hottest day ever recorded here. Why not make hay?" Right. And he sent a beautiful picture. How did it feel? Did you get chills looking at that field of hay?
Not at 110 degrees. I mean, I would run in the other direction. The worst that I can remember having for temperatures was like in the mid 90s on humid days at the top of the barn. Mm-hmm. Like as you stack up and they have that small pocket of air, that was miserable. But that was in the mid 90s, 110. I will say this, there was nothing better in the world that you would ever experience than doing that work at the top of the barn, you know, with those kind of temperatures. And then going and getting, I used to have this pint jar of cold water that I put in the fridge at the start of the day. Oh, that was the best.
Wow. Oh boy, Buster. I'm glad I did not grow up on a farm for many reasons, but especially that one, the one you just described there. Thanks for writing in, everyone. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please follow, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
That's it for today. My thanks to Sarah, Luke, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.